My name is James McMahon. I have obsessive compulsive disorder. Obsessive compulsive disorder, or OCD, is a mental disorder in which the person has repeated thoughts called obsessions, or feels the need to perform routines repeatedly. They might be external or internal. They're called compulsions. To an extent that generates distress or impairs general functioning. I've had it for over 20 years, not that I knew I had it for a long time. We call OCD the Doubting Disorder. It's much misunderstood. Treatment is difficult to come by. Anyone tuning in from the UK will be aware of the crisis point that UK mental health services hit some time ago. At least without paying vast sums of money, but it can be effective. I'm on a journey. I was diagnosed in 2008 when I was 28. I ignored it. My flat was messy. I didn't have OCD. 10 years later, I had what may well have been a breakdown. I fought for another diagnosis. I got it. I've had some treatment now, cognitive behavioural therapy and some ERP, that's exposure response prevention, and I'll get into that on a future episode. My condition has come close to ruining my life, even taking it from me, and I'm far from recovered. Sometimes I'm not sure I ever will be, but I'm in the fight. The OCD Chronicle started as a website, a place to document OCD stories, to celebrate bravery and cheer on other sufferers. And it's a podcast now, and it's here to do a similar thing. But I also want to chart my own story. I want to be better, so badly I want to be better. I'll introduce you to the people I meet on this journey. Mental health professionals, researchers, other sufferers. Join me. I'm kicking off this series with a conversation with YouTuber Izzy Wonders, who does great work online talking about her OCD and her relationship with eating disorders. I'm late to speak to her. Of course I am.
Yeah, sorry I kept you waiting around.
No, it's fine. Honestly, I'm still, after all this time, over a year of COVID, I'm still getting used to Zoom and Teams and everything. It's still, I don't know, it's hard to keep on top of everything.
I spent such a long, jumping straight into OCD, like, I spent such a long time in my life, like, not knowing what I was, not knowing that there was a name for it. And I have so many friends who have OCD now. And whenever we arrange to meet up, there's always like a sort of I'm running late tennis going on. You know, I'll see you in 10 minutes, or can I see you in 20 minutes, or whatever. And a friend of mine with OCD said to me the other day when we were running late, I said, this is like karma for my entire life. Because I do feel a little bit like when there's such a maelstrom of nonsense going on in your head, punctuality sort of takes a bit of a backseat sometimes.
Oh, for sure. Definitely. Yeah. No, of course. So when there's that much chaos, it's like you can't be expected to be on the ball every second. Punctuality definitely takes a backseat for me as well.
Yeah, no, totally. It sort of winds me up, though, because it's that thing, I think, when you have OCD where you know, the world shouldn't really change for you, you know, like the treatment that we go through, like, asks us to challenge how we are. And I feel like sometimes going, I'm really sorry I'm late, I've got OCD, doesn't really sort of like wash really, because the whole point is that I need to kind of live by the society we live in.
Yeah, it's true. I still feel, because I have moments where, you know, events that I'm late for on occasion because of OCD stuff, and I feel it would be so different if I said, oh, I'm sorry I'm late, I was feeling ill, or I was sick, or something like that. But to say, sorry I'm late, I have OCD, it's like a big taboo thing still. I wish I could just be comfortable saying, I've got OCD, that's why I'm running late. But I still manage to find excuses like, oh no, I'm just not feeling great, or the bus was late. I'm like, no, I should just say it and break the stigma.
Well, I made a decision, you know, maybe 4 years ago, that I just wasn't going to not be open, so to speak. And it wasn't really like anything I sat down and thought about. It was just more, I felt for my own sanity, I just couldn't exist without at least explaining to people that maybe there was a reason why there were certain things I found difficult. When did you start to tell people?
I think I started telling very close friends when I was in my mid-teens, when I kind of had my diagnosis and I was trying to make sense of it myself. Because before I'd had my diagnosis, I'd never heard of OCD, because I was young, I was a child, and it wasn't talked about. Mental health awareness was not really a thing. So I think I was in my mid-teens.
Sorry to interject, well, what year was this, just to get an idea?
I think I was diagnosed in about 2010.
Okay.
Yeah. So it was before, you know, social media kind of took a hold of mental health awareness and stuff. So I think I started telling my close friends and family when I'd had my diagnosis, when I was in my early teens and I was trying to explore it and make sense of it. And I needed help with that. But it was less of a, this is part of my life, and more help me understand it kind of a thing. But now I'm much more open talking about it. But even when I'm going into new environments, like a new workplace or something, I'm still not 100% comfortable talking about it because of all the stigma surrounding it and the misunderstandings about OCD.
Do you ever find yourself, this is what happens to me all the time, that I will, not my close friends and not my family, who to a degree, many of them have worked really hard with me to understand it as I've understood it over time, but do you ever find yourself saying to someone, oh yeah, that's my OCD, and they just look at you like you have just dropped from Mars, like they just don't know what it means?
Yes, I think, because when people hear me say it that I don't know very well, they assume I'm saying it as the kind of flippant throwaway, oh, I'm a bit OCD about that. And sometimes I have to explain, actually, no, that's my genuine OCD. That's my condition, rather than I just like things tidy in the cupboard, you know?
Yeah.
So I think when people realize, oh, it's actually an illness, not just an adjective that people throw around to describe a personality trait or a preference, it makes people think, you know?
Yeah. I think that people have to be a certain kind of person to think, though. I think, you know, they have to want to understand. I mean, I'm a writer and you know, I make things, and I'm always, you know, I think that I'm all right at what I do, but I all the time struggle with just articulating just how horrendous this disorder is. Sometimes I get frustrated about it's like depiction on television or in film or whatever, but when it comes down to it, I just think, I don't know really how to articulate it to people, you know?
Yeah, no, I fully understand. I feel the same thing. I think the thing I struggle with is describing an intrusive thought to people compared to just a negative thought or an unhappy thought. The difference between an intrusive thought and a negative thought is it's a huge difference, but to actually, like you said, to articulate that difference is actually really hard. Yeah,
absolutely. I feel like it's so much, it's just one of the things that's so fantastic since I met all the people with OCD is that I feel like I can spend time with them and just not have to explain. I can just be.
Yeah. There's that kind of implicit understanding about that shared experience that, I fully understand. People don't, it's so refreshing to just, be with people who have that base understanding, so you don't have to be like, actually, I have these completely irrational thoughts. It's so refreshing to spend time with people who just understand that.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah, it's brilliant. So, I'm sort of zigzagging all over the place here, but one of the reasons I wanted to speak to you for this podcast is because I really love the stuff that you do on YouTube, and I think that voices like yours are really important.
Thank you.
Yeah. tell me how you came to do that.
I'd wanted to start a YouTube channel for a while, and I wanted to talk about a couple of my passions, and I think those included, you know, travel and various other things, but I ended up gravitating towards mental health because it's one of my interests, but because it's a huge part of my identity as well. And one of my main motivations for making videos on YouTube is I make what I would have found helpful to see when I was going through really bad times. And if I'd seen a video explaining what it's like to go through anorexia or OCD when I was in a really dark moment, it would have made me feel so less alone. And I feel like there is a bit of a gap. Lots of people make mental health videos on YouTube, but I want to come at it from more of an upbeat but genuine angle, I suppose. I think even though the stigma is being broken down a bit on YouTube, it's still very, a lot of illnesses are very glamorized still, and I don't want it to be that way. I want it to be real, and I want it to be ugly at times, because that's the truth of it.
Yeah, no, I mean, I can't, if this was a Facebook post, I would like this enthusiastically. What do you mean glamorized?
I think certainly when it comes to eating disorders, which there's a huge crossover with OCD, so anorexia, bulimia, OCD, big crossovers. In my experience, I think when it comes to presenting that on social media, people find it very hard to get away from the stereotype of it's actually quite fun and attractive to be, you know, struggling with eating and you know, mentally ill. And it seems to be, even now, a bit trendy. And when that's presented on, you know, YouTube and TikTok and Instagram, I find still a lot of people presented in quite an attractive way, in a way that doesn't seem horrendous, which is what it is. It's horrendous to have any mental illness, but it's, I find so few videos and, you know, posts on social media actually express that. I rarely ever see a genuine expression of mental illness on social media, on YouTube, on TikTok, on Instagram. And that's what I was hoping to do with starting my channel and posting on Instagram and things, is just to show that it's not like it is on TV and in the films. To have a mental illness, it's completely different.
No, absolutely. I was just having a conversation with a psychologist that's going to be on a different episode of this podcast the other day about how, like, the frustrations that we feel with the, you know, hashtag it's okay to not be okay, that kind of almost like commodification of that kind of like simple messaging of something which isn't simple at all. And I feel like, you know, as we say, mental illness is ugly. And I think it's a weird one. There's a duality in that people should be able to talk about it, but at the same time, people with mental illness should be, I don't know if it's beneficial to them, their illness, but they should be angry that this is a thing that's come along and impacted their chance for happiness.
Yeah, yeah, I fully agree. And that's my issue with it's okay to not be okay, because of course, like, it's allowed to not feel okay, but actually we deserve treatment, and it's not okay to not feel okay when people with physical illnesses and conditions have, in the UK at least, quite easy access to treatment. And then there's millions of people with really terrible struggles, mental health struggles, who are not feeling okay and are completely denied treatment at every turn. So it's not okay at all to not feel okay.
Absolutely.
When there are options, but we just don't have access to them.
I'm gonna come to that in a second, because the fury that so many of us feel about being abandoned by services that should be there for us, I think is something that's really important to talk about. But while we're on social media, like, you making your YouTube videos, what does that help you or hinder you at all?
I think a bit of both. I think it does certainly help more than it hinders, in that I find that I've had a terrible experience with mental illness, with eating disorders, with OCD, and if I can turn that into something that makes one person feel less alone or helps one person understand one of those conditions a bit better, I feel like that struggle wasn't for nothing. I can actually make something positive out of my experience, which is a big thing for me. I find it hugely helpful and beneficial for my mental health to feel that I can learn from a negative experience, that something positive can come out of it. So I think that's how my YouTube channel and making videos about mental illness has really helped, because I'm really lucky to have met lots of people who have said, actually, it really helped me understand my illness better, or your video made me feel heard and seen. And that's like a really moving thing to hear, because I feel like we're all in this together, and in this weird world we can all connect by social media. And that's one of the perhaps few benefits of social media when it comes to mental illness. I think one of the ways that posting videos and posting about my experience online has hindered me is that I feel a lot of people look to my videos and to my Instagram to see kind of a success story of somebody who is happy in spite of their mental illness. And that is something that I'm eager to portray. You know, you can be happy and you can achieve goals if you are mentally ill. You can have an identity and a life if you're mentally ill. But some days, some weeks, some months, I don't feel like that at all. And I feel like it's all falling down around me. And then I'm a bit nervous to post about that reality, because I don't want to give the impression that I am not making progress, that actually mental illness is making my life worse at this time, because I don't want to make anyone who's watching feel like there's no hope. Hope is such a big message that I want to give on social media, but at the same time I want to be real and you know, show, like you said, the duality of mental illness. So finding that balance of being real but also have a positive approach, that's a tough balance, I think, to find. I don't think I've quite struck it yet, but it's something that I'm hoping to achieve one day.
It is a minefield. I mean, I've written a lot about OCD, but when I just chuck something out into the ether on Twitter, if it is, which, you know, it's just, especially during the pandemic, you know, where there's been sort of so much enforced distance from people, sometimes it's just been a case of getting something out of my head, not always for the best, really. And I could talk all day, really, about how social media, I think, has kind of been the enemy of my OCD in many ways. but also, you know, I'm a journalist, it's a necessary evil. But anyway, what the point I'm trying to get to is that if I say, I had a fantastic night at my OCD support group, I take such strength from other sufferers, like, I will get a lot of likes. If I go, I am currently obsessed that someone I've never met and can't remember the name of is planning on murdering me, and it's a thought that goes round and round and round in my head, and I feel like I'm losing my mind, then people are scared. you don't get the likes, and that shouldn't matter, but social media is inherently a system which is designed to reward, whether that's dopamine hits or whether it's monetization, if this is what we do for a living, the sharing of content. And I think in a weird way, that sort of warps the way that we think about what we share.
Yeah, and I think it reinforces the, especially with OCD, it reinforces the stigma, because, yeah, everyone wants to hear that it's fine to have OCD, you know, you have support and it's actually okay, and it's not that deep, and it's okay to live with. But then as soon as you want to post about the reality of OCD, which is actually pretty scary and super weird at times, you don't, yeah, like you said, people are, they don't understand it, that social media doesn't allow for that nuance. And it kind of reinforces, actually, I'm pretty alone experiencing this right now. So yeah, it does, it can make you feel so isolated in that way.
Yeah, no, totally. I should say that I very recently got diagnosed with binge eating disorder. So that's, you know, OCD and binge eating disorder, that's my my double whammy of wrong brainness. I'm very much in a place of identifying like disordered behavior, which is really good for me. I thought I was just greedy, you know, for a long time. So just sort of saying that as a bit of a caveat, where would you say you were with your inverted commas recovery from the two disorders now?
I think, and this ties into my YouTube channel, in that what I'm trying to raise awareness for is that recovery from anorexia and bulimia is so much more than just regaining the weight that you lost. For me, that was about 5% of the battle. And the 95% came coming to terms with that weight gain and coming to terms with my body and my changing body and how your body changes through life, how your appearance fluctuates and how your eating habits fluctuate, which is a lot. And I think that it's kind of impossible to put a number on where I am in my recovery, but something that I'm really committing to at the moment is not dieting, because since I've regained the weight that I lost, which was, I reached that point a few years ago, I've still really struggled with accepting my body. And I've been off and on diets for years to try and just regain some control, which is where the OCD comes in. And I feel much better when I have control through dieting, whether that's restricting certain food groups or eating at certain times or just imposing a number of rules on my body and on the food that I eat. So what I'm committing to this year is not dieting and moving more towards intuitive eating, which is super hard because as somebody with OCD and an eating disorder, rules and behaviors and rituals are something that have become very, very much a safety net for me. So kind of letting go of that safety net is where I'm at in recovery right now, and trying to just trust my body, trust my brain without those rules, which is a big challenge. But that's where I'm at right now. It's scary, but we're getting there.
Wishing you all the success with it.
Thank you.
How have you found this bizarre 12 months we've had?
It's a tricky one. I am introverted anyway, so it's not been as much of a struggle for me as I imagine more extroverted people have experienced. I'm lucky to live with my boyfriend and a flatmate who I'm very good friends with. I so deeply feel for people who've been on their own, living on their own in this. I can't imagine. I think in terms of how it's affected my OCD is, it's interesting because my OCD is very much related to bad things happening to my family. For instance, I have horrible intrusive thoughts of my family getting car crashes. That's a really common ongoing intrusive thought for me. And having and knowing where all my family are during this pandemic has been super helpful because I don't have to worry about my parents, my grandparents going out and about and falling or getting in a car crash because I know that they're at home. So it's kind of, although it sucks for my whole family to have to stay inside, it's made me feel great because I'm like, I don't have to worry about the intrusive thoughts of them being in a car crash because they're not driving anywhere. Yeah. So in that respect, it's kind of been a bit of a help. But I've noticed as things have started opening back up, as you know, my family are traveling more, the intrusive thoughts have come back more because I've had that break and I've got used to the control of knowing that my family are inside, not doing anything the whole time. So it's something I think I'm going to struggle more when the world opens up a bit and when I have to let go of the reins of control a bit more about knowing where everyone is and what everyone's doing the whole time.
Yeah.
I think that's where, for me, that's where the struggle will be. How about yourself? How's the these 12 months been?
Oh, man, it's been difficult. Well, I mean, I got the binge eating disorder diagnosis during it. And that came about because I had a total crisis with sleep last summer, where I just basically forgotten how to sleep. I'd become scared of sleeping.
Horrible.
Yeah, I got taken to hospital for 10 days, and I think I was pretty close to it becoming a psychiatric issue. And it was, my OCD was just really getting close to being out of control. But just even the kind of the physical, just even the danger I was putting myself in by just going days without sleeping. I was just,
my God, sleep is so important. Yeah,
totally. You know, some of my friends with OCD that are kind of further down the recovery path, said to me, when I sleep like a baby now, I'm sleeping brilliantly, and I hope that remains so. And they were saying to me, when you get more sleep, you will be in a better position to fight your OCD. They're so right. Sometimes now when I am just about to spiral into a very bad bout, I will say, you haven't had enough sleep, go have a few hours. And I normally feel like after that, I'm in a much better position to deal with it. I sometimes feel like one of the things that I find really difficult with the condition is that I'm pretty high functioning. I do two podcasts. I write, I draw, I'm married, I have friends, I don't really feel like, unless you'd see me at my worst, you would look at my life and go, there's much of a problem there. And I think sometimes the thing that's difficult with that is that sometimes people don't know how bad it is, and it's only really my wife, for example, or my mum, who I'm very close to, who can really spot it. And they can see it coming, which is really great. One thing I was going to say about the pandemic though is that there's a lot being said by people who don't really know much about OCD about what a disaster the pandemic will be for OCD. And I think there's I always feel like a lot of the big, and this is all anecdotal, there's no research that backs this up, but I always feel like some of the big themes within OCD, whether that's, I feel like a lot of people my age have an obsession with HIV. And yeah. I feel a lot of that's about the 80s and the misinformation that was circulating. And you know, it's hard for people without OCD to hear this, but paedophilia is quite a common one.
And yeah, feel, no, for sure.
Yeah, and I feel a lot of that is about the media's obsession with it in the early noughties, for example. So I feel like sometimes the things we live through are the things that shape the themes.
Definitely.
And I do think going forward, you know, that would suggest that COVID would be something. But what I've found, actually, is that if we say to ourselves that recovery, I can't speak for anorexia, of course, but if we say to ourselves that OCD, being free from OCD is accepting a lack of control or accepting doubt, the pandemic has been a pretty big exposure, really.
Definitely.
In the sense that, you know, when it happened, I'd just done my first overseas work trip in a long time. I'd been to San Francisco. That was a really big thing for me. That, you know, I'd got on a plane, which I find hugely triggering, and the fatigue I always really struggle with. And, you know, things were kind of opening up for me and I was feeling good about stuff. And then the whole world changed. And in a weird way, as much as that sucks, there's also something going, you can't control things with your thoughts, James, because anything can happen. The world is chaos.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, for sure. I think managing uncertainty is such a huge challenge for so many people with OCD, mental illness in general. And I think, yeah, like you said, the exposure of the pandemic and everyone's plans and lives being up in the air has been a huge wake-up call for a lot of people dealing with mental illness, in that actually this is this weird thing, but it's life, is totally out my hands. And just kind of processing that is a huge life event, I think, for so many people with OCD. Trying to process that disconnect between our little lives and the wider world and everything that goes on in it.
It's weird, you know, like I've always been, you know, fully aware that, you know, we are tiny specks of, I don't want to get this to get too existential, but I've always been very aware that, you know, we are tiny specks of existence on a, you know, a giant planet in a giant universe in a giant solar system, etc. But at the same time, I've sometimes wondered whether that's actually where, I've sometimes wondered where this stuff comes from in a sense as well. Like, you know, I often feel, I've got, again, there's other people like within the OCD community who I've spoken to about this, and they often say that, you know, really trying to understand where OCD comes from isn't particularly helpful.
Yeah.
Because you are kind of giving, you're like legitimizing thoughts, you know, you're looking at thoughts and you're going, this is why, and therefore it emboldens them. But I feel like when I was younger, I just felt so scared all the time. I never really felt safe for lots of reasons. I sometimes feel that's a little bit where this stuff came from, really.
Yeah. I think, like you said, it's so helpful for some people to kind of avoid looking at kind of the root cause of a lot of the thoughts and the intrusive thoughts and the rituals and things. But for many other people, actually, processing where those thoughts come from originally and where those feelings grew from has been hugely helpful. It's been helpful for me because, like you said, for so long I've just felt absolutely baffled and confused about why I felt nervous and on edge and scared the whole time. And by actually, you know, untangling that mess, I can actually make more sense of my thoughts and just feeling kind of in the know about my own brain. At least I'm not in control of it, but at least I know where it's coming from. That's made me feel, you know, a certain percentage better about my situation.
Yeah. So I mean, I guess, you know, I think when we think about our brains and we think about the power of them, I don't think it does. I think, while at the same time accepting the circumstances we exist within are chaotic and we have very little control, I think understanding the big supercomputer in our skull is helpful.
Yeah, exactly. And I think it helps, well, it's helped me at least come to terms with the fact that what I'm going through is an illness, and it's not just that I'm a nervous person and I'm a bit of a weirdo and I don't have a functioning brain. It's actually an illness, and it's something that I can separate from my identity and who I am. And that it's a consequence of, you know, a variety of genetic environmental factors, and kind of separating it in that respect from who I am has been super helpful. And the only way I could really do that is by looking at where it came from and the situations that led to it.
Can I ask you a little bit about treatment?
Yeah, absolutely.
Tell me a little bit about your treatment history.
So when I was first diagnosed with OCD, when I was in my tweens, I think I was about 11, it was the first time I'd ever come into contact with mental health services at all. So I was referred by my GP to CAMHS, so Child and Adolescent Mental Health Services, because I had gone to my mum and I said, listen, I am doing all these behaviours because I think that it will help keep you and dad safe. I am touching the curtain 10 times because I think it'll keep you and dad safe. And I think it's not normal. I don't think that's what other people are doing. And it's actually kind of upsetting me when I can't do that. And I knew it wasn't right. So I went to my mum and she said, yeah, let's go to the GP. I was lucky to have supportive parents who listened and acknowledged that that was something I was struggling with and maybe there could be help for it. I was lucky at the time to be able to be referred without a waiting list to CAMHS, because I don't think that would be the case these days. Where I lived in Wales, there was a space for me, and I was very privileged to have CBT for a number of years in CAMHS for OCD. And then when I developed anorexia, the CBT was for that as well. So I stayed with CAMHS until I was 18, receiving CBT and several other kind of treatments. And then when I turned 18 and was discharged from CAMHS, that's where kind of the mess started with accessing services. And I think it's the same for a lot of other people. When you turn 18 and you go from a very helpful, supportive system, and then you get put into adult mental health services where there's nothing for you, that's a hard thing to process. And I found it very challenging at the time. It sounds like my situation was quite similar to a lot of other people who I've met who attempted to make the transition from child and adolescent mental health services to adult mental health services, which is that when I turned 18, I was discharged from CAMHS and put on the waiting list for a similar service for adults. And the waiting list was 2 years. So I had to go 2 years with no treatment. And during that time, I went many times to, you know, the GP saying, I'm really struggling. I don't think I can go without anything during the 2 years. I had some psychiatric referrals to psychiatrists, which the result from that was basically them saying, yeah, I'm sorry, you have to wait 2 years. And I was kind of just left on antidepressants for however long until a slot came up for me to see someone. But I think it's pretty dangerous to leave someone on antidepressants for like a long time with no check-in. It's bonkers to me. But I think it's a common experience, it sounds like, which is awful.
No, absolutely. When you got the treatment, 2 years is preposterous, but when you got the treatment, how did you find it?
So when I eventually did get treatment, it was when I'd moved from Wales to London, and I mean by that point I, like many other people, would take anything often. So as soon as I said that, you know, you can have some short-term CBT, I was up for it. I was ready to go. I had my apprehensions about short-term CBT, seeing as I'd spent the best part of 10 years in town receiving all sorts of various treatments. My history had been quite complex, but I thought, you know, I'm not going to turn something down from the NHS when I've been waiting so long. So I went for it, and it was short-term CBT. It was about 8 weeks. It was fine. It was really good. I felt like it was entirely aimed at somebody with very mild anxiety or depression, as opposed to somebody like me who's had a history of, you know, chronic mental health conditions. It's the complete wrong service. But what's happening is that service, which is designed for people with very mild mental illness, anxiety, depression, is the only service available for people with acute mental health conditions, which is horrendous. And then people with very mild anxiety and depression have no help at all. So it's kind of the whole system has been shifted down, so that people with very poor mental health get very little support. And then the people with moderate mental health get no support. It's awful. It's just, and it's such a discrepancy. And like we did talk about earlier, it's preventable. It just needs funding, and time and attention. And it would save lives. It would save the lives of the families of the people who go through mental illnesses. It would not just mentally, but physically, I think it mental illness when left untreated for so long, it just makes people really ill. And I've seen it happen to myself, to other people around me. So it makes me angry because it's so preventable.
Yeah, that's a bit of a bridge to what I was going to ask next, actually, which is I'm really, a real turning point in my life was when I met my wife. I had relationships before, and sometimes they had been difficult because of my undiagnosed condition. And I say that with hindsight, because I do feel like with OCD, it's not just the suffering of the sufferer, but it's also the people, it's often the people who love us as well.
Yeah.
How have you found, I mean, you were saying before you were in a relationship, how have you navigated that?
Yeah, I've been lucky to be in a relationship with somebody who's very understanding, but it does make my condition worse to see my partner struggle when I'm ill, because then I feel not only the responsibility of OCD, which is irrational, but I feel the very real responsibility of that person's mental health that is dependent on if I'm well or not. And you know, in an ideal world, there would be support for those people as well, for the families and loved ones of those going through mental illness, because they need support as well. And mental illness is one of those things where you can have somebody who's got poor mental health in the family, and as a consequence, the people who love them get poor mental health. So it's kind of contagious in that way. And I've seen that happen, you know, when I'm unwell, I've seen the people around me, you know, my parents, my family, my partner, become anxious and depressed. And it's horrible to see, because you know that it's not your fault, but you know that it's come from something that you're going through. And if you weren't going through it, it might not be that way. So it's hard to process that, I think.
I think one of the other things that's difficult and probably isn't talked about enough with OCD is that I am always really driven for my wife not to become my therapist.
You
know, she, OCD UK, for example, they did I don't know whether you attended or you've attended before, but they did a fantastic virtual conference last year. And my wife went to a lot of the talks, and often she would come and sit in on the support group that I attend, and they made it very welcome. And she has really learned with me. She sat in on some of my CBT sessions, for example. And often she will be ahead of the curve in understanding OCD better than me. I'm so lucky. I know that's not the situation for so many other people. But one of the things I really have to do is almost sort of trying to take OCD out of our relationship sometimes. because I want her to see me coming down the road and go, hey, that's my boo. Like, that's not the guy that I've got to look after, you know?
Yes, yeah, and you are a person outside of your mental illness, and that's the person that your partner's in a relationship with. So it is, it's really hard to find that space because of how much mental illness becomes embedded in like our daily lives. It's really hard to find that and connect with your partner as a person without that mental illness, because it filtrates to all aspects of life for many people, myself included. So it's a hard thing to do to separate yourself from that, and I think it's quite exhausting at times as well.
Here's another thing I was thinking. So when I talk about OCD on Twitter, and I know it's reached people who have struggled, because I will often get private messages from people saying, I didn't quite understand what was going on with me. And then I went to a doctor and I got a diagnosis. And as you were saying before, I think for me, I always think about me at 19 and how terrified I was, and not understanding what was happening to me. And I often think, if I can contribute to the avoidance of that to a degree, then something good has come out of this. The other thing I'm really conscious of, though, is that there have been people who got in touch with me before and said, my son is having what sounds like your stuff, or is there any chance you could talk to him? And I felt like I've really had to balance being a compassionate person who wants to help and also not overstepping the mark, whereas I'm not a trained mental health professional. I don't want to say the wrong thing. I don't want to make anything worse for anyone. Do you find anything like that with your YouTube channel?
Yeah, so something that I encounter a lot, and I feel very fortunate in the sense that a lot of people watch my videos who are going through eating disorders and message me. And I make it clear on my channel, I'm happy to talk to people about what they're going through on a friend-to-friend level, because I think, you know, as we were talking about earlier, lots of people don't have anyone to talk to about it. Some people don't want to bother their family about it. Some people, they are aware that it's making their family stressed and traumatized if they talk about it. I want people to feel like they have an outlet, and I'm happy to be that outlet. But like you said, I'm acutely aware of not becoming a therapist. I don't, for these people, I don't know these people. You can never know someone over just messaging on Instagram and Twitter and things. You just don't know someone, and I'm happy to purely empathize and listen. And I think that's a really important thing that I think I'm able to do as just a friend to people. But what's happened over the years is I've received a larger volume of messages of people who have put so much time and thought into their messages, saying their story, telling me about their struggles, and they want advice. And that seems to be the thing that people look for in my channel, is how did you get to the point where you seem to be having a happy life when you were deeply unwell before? And I, with the sheer number of messages and the amount of thought and time put into each one of those messages, I don't feel I can give a valued response to each one of those people, in as much as I want to fully engage and talk about them and their journeys and what they can look forward to and what they value in life and what they live for. And I can't do that with everybody who messages me. And then I end up feeling very guilty, because I said I'm here for you, and I just can't be there for for everybody, but I want to be.
Yeah, no, totally. It's a real balancing act.
Yeah.
Where can people watch your YouTube channel? I mean, the obvious answer is YouTube, but how would they find it easily after listening to this?
Search for Izzy Wanders on YouTube, and also you can find me on Instagram at Izzy Wanders. Yeah, plain and simple, just Izzy Wanders, and there's lots of videos about OCD and eating disorders and mental health in general. Yeah.
And what do you think the future is for the YouTube channel? Is it what it is now, or is there anything you want to grow it into being? Or?
For me, one big thing that I would like to focus on with my channel is exploring the more stigmatized mental illnesses. At the moment, I've spoken a lot about my experience with OCD, anorexia, bulimia, but I'm a student mental health nurse at the moment, and I'm realizing that there's a lot more stigma out there surrounding other mental illnesses, you know, schizophrenia, psychosis, that they need awareness raised around those as well. And so I'm hoping to, as I qualify as a nurse and learn more about other psychiatric conditions, I'm really hoping to explore those more and raise awareness for those and destigmatize them, and yeah, really broaden out my content into other areas of mental health as well.
Fantastic. Thanks loads for speaking to me today, Izzy.
Thank you for chatting. It's been really fun, and it's like you said, it's so lovely to speak to people who understand about OCD. It's so refreshing.
The OCD Chronicles is brought to you by sufferers of OCD, not mental health professionals. This is a place to educate and inform from a perspective of lived experience, but not to advise. Thankfully, the United Kingdom is lucky enough to have two great charities for OCD and their related disorders. One is called OCD UK, the other OCD Action. I personally have found them hugely helpful in my long and storied journey with this wretched disorder. You can find them easily enough online. Solidarity with sufferers. OCD is hell, but there is hope. The OCD Chronicles is brought to you by James McMahon, that's me. It's a Spook Media production. Until next time.